How might art help each of us bridge the bias gap that exists? Stay tuned as we find out on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yes, those are my babies, as always. Thanks for getting daddy started today. Mwah. Multimedia artist Biate Ross Smith is with us. And Biate, I'm curious, why does art matter in the midst of a serious conversation?
Oh, well, thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show. Sure. I think art matters in the midst of serious conversations because art speaks to our subconscious as a society and as individuals. And so it often reflects our hopes, our dreams, our perspectives on things that often can't be said concisely in words. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very important in terms of directing our perceptions and our notions about one another and a lot of the implicit feelings we have about our society.
What does it mean to be thoughtful about the media that we consume?
That's a great question. I think the media we consume is kind of like food. There's certain things like ice cream and cake that are tasty as a dessert. We really enjoy them in certain moments, but they don't fuel us as we go about our day, our weeks, our years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to be aware of the quality of the media you consume and how it impacts your perception of the world around you and how it exercises your mind.
When you look at, and I assume you look at or at least familiar with, let's say Fox. Fox News is the is the conservative side.
Right.
I don't know what the liberal side is.
I think it's MSNBC.
Is it MSNBC?
Okay. Kind of the equivalent.
Okay. So when you look at the dichotomy between the two, what add that to the conversation that we're having right now, what comes up for you?
Well, I think it's really, really important for us as Americans, no, as world citizens and thinking people, to be really aware of scrutinizing the things we hear in the news that we agree with. It's easy to hear things that you agree with and you like and just run down that one train of thought. And we always have to scrutinize the things we agree with and the things that appeal to us to make sure that we're getting multiple sides, multiple perspectives on a story and informing ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think that's critically important because, again, everyone likes to hear things they agree with, but I think it's really important. You can really tell someone's character in a debate or a discussion depending on how they acknowledge the validity of opposing perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Mm-hmm. Does that mean we should watch Fox and NBC? Or MSNBC, or does that mean we should maybe watch just a third option that does better straight down the middle? And I don't know what that option is. Is what, CNN the better? I don't know. But go on.
Well, you know, I have a certain perspective on this. I tend to prefer to not get my news from television unless it's local. Mm-hmm. I tend to advise people to get their news from what were traditionally print sources, because I think philosophically they come from a background where they went into more depth with their reporting and information. The beauty of nowadays is that due to the internet, you can get a variety of different news sources. So you can look at the New York Times, you can look at BBC, you can look at agency of French press, you can look at a variety of different news sources globally. I don't really have a good South American news source that I can recommend to people, but my point is that when you look at news sources from different perspectives, different regions, that helps you get a fuller picture on certain stories.
Mm. Wow. You know, usually we cut straight to me welcoming, but this has gotten interesting already. Jeff, you have you have quite a background in radio and media, but not just in D.C. and not just even national. You got an international perspective. How do you weigh in on what Baitez just said?
Well, the big difference is people in America don't realize. Most people in America don't realize how
biased.
Well, not just biased, how the media has slanted our view of the world and of ourself. Okay, I work for an international news network. The headline story isn't always America. It isn't me, me, me.
Right.
Okay, what we're hearing about isn't what you see on CNN or ABC. A lot of stuff going on out there. That's why this most recent election, that's why a lot of the things that the Bush administration did internationally tarnished the way Americans are viewed. And it's not just the media. It's real factual, it's boots on the ground stuff that I've seen. It has changed my view of the way I view America.
Interesting.
Because you can't be that arrogant and selfish. Well, we can. We are.
right.
But, you know, what journalism should be and what journalism is are two different things. You mentioned Fox. You mentioned MSNBC. Half of the viewers, at least on the side of Fox, that's all I can attest to, are viewing it for entertainment. I'm not watching Bill O'Reilly as a real reporter. I'm watching him to laugh at how ridiculous he can be or his slant on what... on the way that which he views the world. Same goes for a lot of conservative right-wing commentators. Listen to Rush Limbaugh. There are a lot of people who buy into that. They're the lemmings that follow him off the cliff. But to be real honest, to me, it's laughable and then criable.
Right.
Because people do take it seriously.
Absolutely.
So I don't overstate, I don't want to understate the importance of journalism in our lives. A lot of it is entertainment. And that goes right to TMZ and ET and Access and any of what are called reality shows, which are entertainment.
Yeah.
To a lot of people, that's their world.
Yes.
Okay. And that's why, not to change or veer the subject into what's happened recently, Donald Trump was a reality show host.
Yeah.
Okay.
Indeed.
Who had a board game named after. I mean, we can go on and on and on. But... so, yes, he's on people's minds. He's in their hearts and in their homes, you know, every week for a period of years. Of course, they're familiar with him. Anyhow.
And you know, when you think about Trump, I think about Lethal Weapon 2. And I'm really on a tangent here. Okay.
Oh,
Lethal Weapon
2,
Danny Glover, when they discover they find all this money these South Africans have been stockpiling. And Danny Glover's like, God, and this is like Donald Trump Lotto. You know, his name, and Lethal Weapon 2 came out in the 90s. Mm-hmm. His name was synonymous with wealth.
Wealth, yeah. Obscene wealth.
And Americans aspire to wealth. And so there's something to be, you know, he had something going on at many levels.
Yeah. Oh, he played it right.
Yeah.
He certainly, and that's half of it. The other half, which is embarrassing to me as an American, is how... racist we really are. Because regardless of how, and I don't want to get political, it's your show, but regardless of how negative, regardless of your negative feeling about Hillary, regardless of the fact that you cannot vote for her because of this typical politician, she lies, blah blah blah, we would have had 4 years of indictments, how can you bring yourself to vote for Trump when he did everything wrong? But apparently he did everything right.
Yeah, he did something right. Somebody voted for him. Oh, okay. Can I bring it in now?
Please. Is Baitez still on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Welcome to Frank Relationships, a show for you, my brethren, who, like me, are too young to be considered old and too old to be considered young. It's also for those of you who love and support us. We're here to provide weekly wisdom, conversation, and information that'll help create loving and flexible parents and partners. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us. And then via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get the show each week. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please give us a favorable iTunes rating. And please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We're always looking for new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my super-duper co-host, Nancy.
Good morning, Frank.
Nancy Goldring, the consummate generalist.
Indeed.
Yes, yes.
I'm very happy about that title now.
Today's guest is a conceptual artist known for exploring issues and preconceived notions of identity and beauty, cultural traditions, and anthropology. His projects constantly question and challenge our concepts and biases related to race and other demographics. And I might say he does a very good job with it, demonstrating insight and skill. So, if you, like me, want to know what redefining black male identity in America means and what in the world a question bridge is, then stay tuned as your Frank Relationship team talks with photographer, multimedia artist, filmmaker, and educator, Mr. Biate Ross Smith. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. That was a great intro. I need to utilize that in the future. You really sound very impressive.
Hey.
Awesome.
I would say you're very impressive.
And well, thank you. I appreciate that.
You can steal it from the transcript. We transcribe the show. So
yes.
But before we get too deep in today's subject matter, I want to check in to see what's going on in the news. I'm saying that as if we haven't already done that. But
right, some level.
Yeah, we actually have a segment for that. So, Biate, please don't be bashful. We certainly want your thoughts too. Okay. People like us more when we share information about ourselves, even if that information seems unflattering. Yes?
Well,
no?
I think it kind of makes you more, or at least seem more accessible as a person, more human.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that TMI, too much information, is actually a good thing?
Well,
I would think not, but
I mean, see,
that's what this is implying.
It is kind of implying that, unless it's too much information. I mean, maybe there's a gradient to it all. When you share information that seems unflattering, maybe I don't, you know.
Well, sometimes I think more so than the whole TMI thing. Let's say I ask you something and then you decline to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's a little bit more. It's kind of like you're guarded. You're not willing to let me in.
That was actually said in this article that I was reading,
okay,
where it was like someone not answering a question can seem off-putting.
Yeah.
And answering it with more information, I guess, except during an interview, a job interview, you want to.
Well, technically, we're always interviewing when you get right down to it. Mm. It's just a matter of how cool the person doing the talking is.
Okay.
Or doing the asking is, I guess.
Oh, we're always getting to know one another.
Yeah, on some level.
All right. Biate, what you got?
Well, I always, my challenge is to be concise when I convey information, particularly about myself. I don't want to be one of those people who just talks about themselves on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But I also really want to communicate effectively. And so a lot of times I'll go into detail to make sure I'm articulating myself correctly. So that's encouraging in terms of that regard. It just makes me wonder how that'll be interpreted if we're going to run into like a period of oversharing once that information gets out.
That's real. Sometimes
people
talk too much.
The nation is on oversharing overload.
That's true. Facebook. Yeah,
oh
yeah.
My goodness!
Yeah, and people taking pictures of their food,
or telling you they're in the bathroom. Like, why do I need to know that?
Right.
Actually, a friend and colleague of mine has a project where he does that. He's Now I'm going to seem racist. I forget what Hassan's ethnicity is. I want to say it's something South Asian, but he's American, and he started this project where he would document all the mundane things in his life and send it to the FBI based on him getting stopped coming through customs after September 11th.
Oh, my goodness.
Interesting project. His name's Hassan Elahi.
Elahi?
Let me get this right.
A-L-H-I-E? Oh, H-I?
He's
I believe it's phonetic. E-L-A-H-I.
Now, that's a reality show I'd watch. That's awesome.
All of the mundane things.
See what happens.
And send it to the FBI.
Shoot it as a documentary.
That, you know, with information, it also has to be monitored. So if you're getting that much information on everybody, then you have to create a whole other system to maintain that information.
Right.
But he would like send them, he sent them like multiple pictures, like in the bathroom, what he had for lunch, like all that mundane stuff.
What?
You bring up a interesting belief that I have. I don't even think it's just simply a belief. I believe it to be fact that every time we create a solution, quote unquote, a solution, we're creating
problem.
A new problem.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Unintended consequences, I like to call it.
So, yeah, while monitoring has increased significantly, people are being watched. Well, who's going to digest all the information and what you're going to do with it?
Please don't start sending your information to the FBI. I want to keep coming here on Thursday.
I'm a bit older than you guys, but when I was in high school, required reading was a novel called 1984.
Oh, my gosh.
George Orwell?
Yep. Yeah. Now, we're a few years past that, even though I read it a few years prior to that. But that's how we live. There's cameras on every corner.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know.
Go back and read it now.
Yeah. But, it predicted. One of the rules I gave my kids when they went to college was the shoulder rule. Before you do something questionable or after midnight. No, make believe someone is watching you from your shoulder that you might have to answer to, whether that's me, your grandmother, whoever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's your conscience,
basically.
And be true to that. That's the camera to me. That's called discipline and all of that. But more to your point, Frank, is it people sharing information about themselves or others delving into it and wanting to share?
Mm-hmm.
You know, politics is easy. Even entertainment and athletics is even more easy because they're in the public eye.
Yeah.
But now it's everybody. It's everybody. And if you're talking about yourself, is that sharing information or is it bragging?
Mm.
Oh, mm-hmm. Boy. Yeah, that really.
Or
man.
Something.
The
It's called eye disease, where every sentence starts with the word me, my, or I. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But isn't everything that we talk about us anyway? Even if I'm talking about you.
Sure, my opinion.
I'm talking about my thoughts about you.
Absolutely.
Hmm. Well, Bayate, actually, so you said something about this, Bayate. You said something about how we get to know people in sort of one facet of them, like let's say all I know of you is what happens when we come here to do the show.
You're talking to me?
Yes, I'm talking to you, Frank. So then I get this impression that how I perceive you when you come here to do the show is how you are.
Mm-hmm.
Not ever stopping to consider that you have you wear many other hats and faces, and that I may not know you as well as I think I do.
I think it's safe to say that I'm as gorgeous and smart and genius all the time as you think I am in the studio.
You see how urgent it was to get you on?
See, that's not bragging. That's just sharing.
Right. This is just fact. The people want to know.
I had a really profound thought that is so far gone now. I can't even recover it to share it. Oh, my God.
Oh,
my goodness. But it is one of those things where, you know, it's one of those things that we know intellectually, but it's important for us to actually feel it so that we can put a little more effort into just creating that as a constant part of our awareness. You know, there's like the proverbial story of like when you're a kid and the first time you see like your teacher in school, like at the store, and you're like, oh my God,
he
or she like actually buys groceries and eats, you know, it's like, well, of course they do. But, and on some level, you know that, but it's still like, oh, worlds are colliding type of thing. But I think, you know, as adults, it's important for us to understand that, yes, you know, everyone is the star of their own narrative. For, you know, for me, it's the Baite show and everyone else is a supporting character. But also to be aware that that is my perspective on the world and to attempt to shake myself out of that way of feeling in the world as often as possible, just so I do have that awareness that that's the perspective I'm coming from.
Baite, I've got a clip related to the spirit the behind your work. Here we go.
When we interact with other human beings, we get focused on a specific aspect of who they are and don't think of each other as complete people. If you ask someone, what does that mean to be black? What does it mean to be blonde and a woman? There'll be millions of different perspectives. Those demographic checkboxes don't really tell you anything aside from what someone looks like. What you really want in terms of diversity is diversity of thought.
Diversity of thought. What does it mean and why is it important?
Well, I think that, you know, that stems from my time in the San Francisco Bay Area when I was in grad school. And I remember going to different events, particularly events in the arts, and there's a lot of talk about celebrating diversity. And I kind of chuckled to myself. I'd look around and I'd see a bunch of people that looked different. But then I was like, well, everyone kind of thinks the same. They have the same philosophy. And, you know, in a very Bay Area, Northern California way, I would just think to myself, I'd chuckle. I'd be like, I bet you if someone came into this room and said they were Republican, everyone would lose it. So I'm like, do we really want diversity or do we just want to feel like we want different people around and just have them all act the same? And I think when we really get into diversity, it is the way that people think. Now, obviously, you have to have people that look different. That's a starting point, because if people look different, they're going to engage with the world differently, which is going to lead to different ways of thinking. But that's still only a start. So we want to, you know, think with some depth about the idea of diversity, in my opinion.
If we bring in the concept of relationships, because that's ultimately what we talk about here. How does diversity in a relationship, particularly a romantic relationship, how does it have relevance and why is it important, if it's important?
That's an excellent question. I am not a relationship expert by any means. But I guess when I think about that, I think about the fact that a lot of us often talk about and think about the type of person we want to be with or want to have in our lives when it comes to a romantic relationship. But many of us don't think about who we need to be in order to actually be able to engage with that person and maintain a relationship with that person and be a productive partner for that person. And so the way that connects to diversity of thought is, from my perspective, understanding different ways of doing things and living one's life, and understanding that because someone does one particular set of things in their personal life, that does not have to impact you. And, you know, we have to let people be who they are if it's not really, you know, having a substantial impact on someone else's lives. So understanding what ideas and concepts are important for an individual and where the line is in terms of that, you know, spilling over and being relevant to people outside of that individual.
I'm going to add to that and say that the diversity, well, not just diversity, but being allowing a person, even a partner, to just simply be who they are is a way of embracing diversity because, I mean, that's it's a way of showing acceptance. It's a way of putting your arms around a person and saying, I accept you as you are, not as I insist that you be, and not even as I predetermined that my partner needed to be, but as we discover. And there's a discovery. There's discovery in relationships throughout the entirety of that relationship. You're always getting to know one another. What you got? I see your, yeah.
He's got that.
I want to get back to the racial aspect of the world.
Okay.
I actually asked an African-American pundit leader once if he ever consciously made a decision, not as a black man. Mm-hmm. Does your race and what that race has dealt you in society affected the way you make decisions? The obvious answer is yes, but I don't know that I make a decision as a white man.
You said the obvious answer to your question
was
him.
Yes. I mean, it would
he
have.
He does or he does not?
It does. It would have to be.
Oh, you're saying so how he makes a decision is always colored by the flat.
Not always, but the tools with which he makes those decisions have been fueled by his color, his culture.
Got it.
You know, everybody's an individual, which is I do agree with you about being diverse. Mm-hmm. You know, someone with the exact same genetic makeup as me is different than me. Mm-hmm. You know, diversity. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested. Do you consciously make decisions based on being someone black in America? Right down to where you're going shopping, to what car you bought, to how you react to a police officer.
Mm-hmm. Bayate.
And you're asking me that? Okay.
Yes, directly.
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that, because I think it's so simple and yet so complicated at the same time. It really depends on circumstances and environment. So race, though it's not actually real, racism is, and so that's impacted culture and ethnicity in the United States and in the Western Hemisphere. So, you know, the context for the situation is very different, depending on the circumstances. You know, when I'm in the United States of America, I make a lot of decisions just based on my cultural background and understanding that I'm probably going to be perceived a certain way based on race. Mm-hmm. That being said, you know, I went to a HBCU.
Which
live in
one?
Harlem. I conduct myself in a very different way when I'm in situations where I'm around black people. Mm-hmm. I conduct myself in a slightly different way when I'm around Latino people, right? Because, you know, theoretically, Latino people could be anything and be Latino. So mm-hmm. right. I could be around black, brownish Latinos. I could be around, you know, more white, Univision Latinos. And that's going to dictate kind of how I will conduct myself. I don't speak Spanish very well, so that's going to impact that. You know, I conduct myself differently being on this radio show. This is an interesting dynamic because you don't really know what someone looks like. So you're operating based on cultural signifiers, based on their voice and the things that they say. So all those things kind of shift. I think it's unfortunate that race plays such a huge role in how we interact with one another in the United States. It's definitely interesting to compare that to how things are internationally. I've felt the least black in two different places that I traveled to in the world. One was when I was in West Africa because everyone was black, and I was in Ghana, and I just felt so normal and so much like just a regular citizen because I was immersed in this black environment. The other time I was in Poland, and I was like one of two black people I saw the entire time I was there. No, I saw three. I saw one other guy in the airport. And in that situation, because I was so different from everyone else, it just kind of went without saying that I wasn't Polish, and then that was that. Like, there wasn't really much else happening there. But I didn't really think about it after initially being there.
Would you share your Poland hip-hop story?
My Poland hip-hop story? Did I tell you guys the story about going to the club named Harlem in Poland?
You didn't tell us, but I did my research.
In public. in the past.
Right.
Oh yeah, that was crazy. So I was with my friend. I was out there with my friend Rob doing a performance at the Zahinta National Gallery in Warsaw. Big ups and shout outs to the Zahinta National Gallery for bringing us out there and having us have a great experience. And shouts to my boy Rob. I think he's in Hawaii right now with his family. But so we go out there to do this performance at this at the National Museum because they're doing a show on African American artists called Black Alphabet. So we go out there, we do the performance, and then you know, we're hanging out with the Polish people afterwards. And so we're going to these Polish clubs, you know, and drinking vodka and everything. And then this one girl is like, oh, I want to take you to one of our hip-hop clubs out here. So we're like, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, you know, go to a hip-hop club in Poland. That'll be fun. Uh-huh. So we go to this club, and the club is called Harlem. And we walk into the club, and there's these posters all over, like these huge posters all over the walls of all these different, like, Black American iconic people. Mm-hmm. From, like, ball players to rappers, you know, like, it's like Jay-Z, Nas, Tribe Called Quest. It's like Allen Iverson is up there. Like, you know, the only white dude was Eminem. And but everyone in there is Polish. We were, like, the only Black people to walk in there. And we walked in, and it was just like, I mean, the club didn't stop, but it almost felt like that point in a movie where it was just like, and everyone looked and was like, it
Black
felt like, oh my goodness, it's actually there.
They live.
But it was one of those things where it was like, it's like one of those moments that you think that you want, like you want that celebrity moment, like, yeah, the girls are going to love me. But when there's that sort of, trying to think of the right word, that sort of idolization within the context of lack of experience and exposure, mm-hmm. It can become really weird really quickly, you know? And, you know, that's not to say anything negative about, our friends over in Poland who ran that club Harlem. Mm-hmm. They just, you know, really liked certain aspects of Black American culture and didn't have access to Black Americans, mm-hmm. In many cases, until, you know, we were probably some of the first few Black Americans they had met, particularly in that circumstance. But it just was kind of bizarre. And it became like, yeah, it was just weird to be like, okay, so how do I handle myself in this situation? Because this is actually like a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you're in a club, so it's not the place where you're, you know, people are engaging in the most responsible of behaviors to start out with. So, yeah, that was a really fascinating experience for me.
Did you walk up to one of the pretty girls and say, I'll take you?
I did not. It's like one of those things that you think you would do, but then when you're in that situation, you're like, whoa, let me make sure I understand all the dynamics of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, people spoke English fairly well. Obviously, their English was better than my Polish. But, you know, again, it's a club. It's loud. I was just like, let me be careful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Smart.
Right.
What's going on in there?
Right.
But it was fun. I mean, you know, once we figured everything out, we had a lot of fun. Everyone was really nice. I mean, people in Poland, they were cool. They were, like, really, really, really kind and really generous. And again, you know, I didn't really, aside from, I mean, that moment, I obviously felt very Black in Poland.
But not in a negative way.
I didn't think about it for a lot of the time I was there. Mm-hmm.
By the way, you don't need to go to Poland for a similar experience. There's plenty of places in America where you can walk in and be the only
right.
person
oh,
of a certain
my goodness.
Race.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eddie Murphy in 48 hours.
Right. Well, you just want to walk out.
Wow.
You want to be.
That was interesting because that was a situation where it was like the difference was legitimate. Like here, we're all Americans and there's different subcultures. But, you know, I mean, there shouldn't be necessarily such a stark difference between all of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the other thing that's interesting about traveling. You know, you travel. I was talking with someone who I was interviewing for a project about this the other day. Like, I feel my Americanness more when I travel outside the country, because I'll meet someone who will be from a place in this country that I may not want to visit, who I would typically think I wouldn't have anything in common, but you meet them in Europe or South America or somewhere, and you start realizing pop cultural references, things you've watched on TV, different jokes. You realize that there are a lot of commonalities.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're talking with photographer, multimedia artist, filmmaker, and educator, Mr. Biate Ross Smith. Biate, please tell us what you're up to and how we can find you.
Yes. Well, currently I have a couple of different projects going. I'm doing a series of sculptures that I create that are made out of boomboxes. And these are site-specific sculptures. And what I do is I create these sculptures in specific areas. Generally, I try to do them in historically significant neighborhoods around the country. Mm-hmm. And I then speak to local residents and collect a list of their favorite songs. And then I also speak to them about their memories from that particular environment and have them tell me about their memories in the form of a story. Mm-hmm. And so the boombox sculpture then plays this soundtrack comprised of local people's favorite songs, mm-hmm. as well as their memories. So it almost becomes like an audio portrait of a community. I'm coming from this tower made of boomboxes. Well, it's not always a tower. I've been creating some recently that look like robots that have mm-hmm. a humanoid form. Mm-hmm. But the point is that these boomboxes, an object that's iconic for community music, is now this vessel for exploring the perspectives of one's neighbors and also telling the story of this particular community. I just completed one with the Amistad Center up in Hartford, Connecticut, that's installed at the main branch of the Hartford YMCA. And let me see, I'm also doing some work currently with the New York Times right now for the next few months. I'm working with their race-related team, creating interactive multimedia projects that explore race and how it impacts daily life. And I have a show of artwork up in Belgium, in Antwerp, right now for the next several months. I think that comes down in January.
Wow. Okay. Why art, especially as a profession?
You know, it kind of was just like the natural flow of my life. I started off working as a photographer because I was into photography as a teenager, and this was back when you had to learn how to shoot film. There was no digital, mm-hmm. so you weeded certain people out that way,
yeah.
In terms of who was really invested. It's kind of like when they first start throwing curveballs when you're playing baseball, and that's like eliminates a whole bunch of people from that sport. There's all those different benchmarks as you get older.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I was really into photography, and I went to school. I went to FAMU, Florida A&M, for undergrad, and I was studying business administration because I thought, you know, I'd be better off if I was in a position to manage people as opposed to be managed. Mm-hmm. But studying business wasn't really for me in terms of, like, you know, you think business, you're going to just be learning how to manage people, but you have to take all these classes and, like, corporate finance and all that stuff, and I couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that, you know, photography was something that I enjoyed, and it occurred to me that I should be investing in something that was fulfilling. That was the reason why you spend time and money in college, as opposed to falling into that traditional trap that I think a lot of us fell into for a long time of thinking that you go to college to train yourself to get a job, mm-hmm. which is actually not quite correct. And so talking with my parents and my elders, fortunately, I had some really good elders within my family and some good mentors, I decided to switch my major to photography. At FAMU, photography was through the School of Journalism. So my first foray into photography professionally was photojournalism work. I worked for Knight Ritter, the Knight Ritter Newspaper Corporation back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, with all the changes and shifts in media, you know, I was advised by a lot of people to really explore broadening my skill set so I could be marketable in a wide variety of ways. So I decided to go to graduate school. And in graduate school, I studied fine art because I wanted to add more skills to my ability to engage in visual language. And so I still take a storytelling, a fundamental, like underlying, I should say, storytelling approach to the work that I make. But the great thing about art is it allows you a variety of different ways, a variety of different mediums to tell those stories and engage in those subject matters. And so it can really be applied to almost any situation or circumstance one finds themselves in. So some of the artwork I do, what I do is I think about the story I want to tell and the message and top and subject matter I want to engage in. And then I think about what's the best medium for that. So it could be a sculpture. Mm-hmm. It could be a performance. It could be a traditional photograph. It could be a T-shirt. It could be a drawing. It mm-hmm. could be video. It could be a combination of those things. And so that really allows me to work in a variety of different areas effectively.
In some ways, your art actually starts with the medium, how you're going yes. to present the idea or the issue and that sort of thing. And then it goes further into what you put onto that medium or how you create it or, do art
bring
to it.
Bring it to bear. Mm.
Does that
yeah,
about
the most
right?
important thing is the idea. And then very often, you have to learn additional skills in order to execute the project. So with these boombox sculptures I was telling you about, the first time I created one that was going to be outdoors, I was working at Franconia Sculpture Park up in Schaefer, Minnesota. It's like 45 minutes outside of the Twin Cities. Great place. If you're ever in the Twin City area, make sure you visit Franconia mm-hmm. as well as the Walker. But I had to learn to weld in order to finish that project, and mm-hmm. I didn't know how to weld before. So mm-hmm. I had to have people teach me how to weld, and then I had to practice it and get decent enough at it to be able to weld and put the sculpture in public.
So you're ultimately learning as you go, whatever it is, yeah. Whatever direction you decide to take it in, you got to acquire new skills, and it's a whole, that's
exciting all by itself.
Yeah.
Almost literally a never stop learning commercial mm-hmm. in my life. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You have a website where we can check you out?
Yes, you can find my work at, I have two URLs, but I'll tell you the one that's easiest to remember. It's myfirstname.net, so byete.net, that's B as in boy, AYETE.net. That takes you to the URL, which is basically myfirstandlastname.com. Mm-hmm. But you can find my work there, and you can also find me on social media.
Tell me about the concept around the question bridge.
So Question Bridge was an amazing project to be a part of. It's a collaborative project that I worked on with several of my friends and colleagues, an artist by the name of Hank Willis Thomas, another artist named Chris Johnson, and another artist named Kamal Sinclair. We also have some great executive producers on that project, Dr. Deborah Willis, actor Delroy Lindo, and actor Jesse Williams. And Question Bridge is based on an idea that my colleague Chris Johnson had, which was to create a means of people communicating across different geographic and cultural barriers using video. And so what happened was Chris had experimented with this concept in the 90s, and then Hank and I ended up going to graduate school at the college where Chris taught. Hmm. And Hank rediscovered that project going through some old videotapes that had been sent to his mother, because she was a very prominent curator and photo historian. And he became aware of the project, and he thought, this idea of question bridging would be interesting to apply to the Black male community. And so he approached Chris about kind of rebooting, remixing the idea of Question Bridge. And once they started working, I've known Hank for a while, he reached out to me because he felt that I would be a good member of the team to include in the creative process. Mm-hmm. So what we did with Question Bridge was we traveled around the country for several years, having black males, pose questions to one another and answer questions of each other via video. So we didn't tell anyone what to ask or how to answer. We simply set up a scenario to film them, and we told them, we know you have another question for another black man you feel different or strange from. Look into the camera and ask your question as if you're talking to them. Hmm. We then showed those videos to people we thought could answer those questions, and they answered looking into the camera as if they were talking to the original man who asked the question. And so that was then woven together to create the sense of experiencing, if you're a viewer of Question Bridge, to give you the sense of experiencing a conversation that you normally wouldn't be able to witness and also probably normally wouldn't be able to take place without the use of technology. The underlying idea being that there's often as much diversity within a demographic as outside of it. And so by opening this window into black male consciousness, by allowing people to experience this conversation about a variety of different topics and see these faces of a variety of different people who all identify as black and male, that kind of explodes the myth that a demographic is one thing and allows black males to represent and redefine themselves on their own terms. And Question Bridge is also something that we call the transmedia or new media project, meaning it uses multiple platforms to engage its viewers. So outside of art speak, what that actually means is it takes multiple forms. So Question Bridge is an art installation. It's a 80-minute film. There's a version of it that's an 80-minute film. We've created a book edited by Dr. Deborah Willis and Natasha Logan, which illustrates a lot of the content, a lot of the conversations in text form. We've also created a curriculum that can be utilized with high school students. We have an interactive website, and we have a mobile app where people can continue to add to the dialogue and conversation, because there's only so many people we can reach traveling around the country as artists. And we're very pleased that Question Bridge has been is being exhibited at the National Museum of African American History and Culture at the Smithsonian.
Nice.
And through mid-January, everyone still has an opportunity to go to the website or utilize the mobile app to create a profile and record themselves asking or answering questions to other black men. If you identify as a black man, you can do that and add to the archive before we stop taking contributions, and the archive is just maintained by the Smithsonian.
And to take this one step further, we've got a Question Bridge clip.
All right, my question is, I try to live good, but I'm surrounded by bad. And I want to know what it is I could do to do better and live peaceful, surrounded by all evil. How can I do that?
I think you have to stand up to evil. If you're not willing to stand up and be yourself in the face of death, you're never going to find out who you really are.
The way to stay out of trouble, and there's so much around you, is, you know what I mean, find more activities to get into, possibly a job, you feel me? Be your own man. Don't hang in groups. You know what I mean? Just follow yourself, man. Listen to your own self. Be a leader, not a follower.
In my experience, whenever I tried to live good surrounded by evil, I had to keep putting good inside of me. I had to keep dealing with everything that I knew that was good. I had to stay positive, had to stay prayed up, and had to stay with my faith. Because if you have something strong to hold on to or any type of faith, I guarantee that evil will pass you by.
Well, first of all, you can stop generalizing and saying all evil, because I'm quite sure it ain't everything evil out there. You just have to learn to distinguish what crowds you want to hang around and which ones you don't. And the ones you see that got the same interests that you do, then try to blend or flop towards that particular crowd or something. But to say all evil, I mean, there's no such thing as all evil, I'm quite sure.
Brother, I know it's hard out there. When I was younger, you know, I was surrounded by a lot of negativity too. And I decided to take the road less traveled. I separated myself from a lot of negativity. I dropped a lot of my negative ways. I took myself out of the community. You know, I got away from the concrete, went out to the ocean, you know, went to the library, went to museums. So this a way, brother. I know it's hard out there. You know, the difficulties are everywhere. What I had to do, I had to change it, you know. We always taught proper education, always correct errors. So when I saw brothers that were negative on the street corner, I tried to encourage them. So I took a negative and made it a positive. So a lot of those things that I didn't like around me, I used my love for my people to kind of like change things. And I did. And I was very fortunate.
There you have it. You know, my favorite feedback from what I just played was when one brother said, "You're generalizing."
Yeah.
There's no all evil.
Yeah. So,
thank you. So, what's the feedback been like from projects of this nature?
Well, we've gotten some very, very positive feedback on Question Bridge. During the process, it was a bit challenging because we were doing something that was new that hadn't really been done before. Mm-hmm. And so as we were seeking funding and support, a lot of people just simply didn't understand how to support something that was a nonfiction project that wasn't a traditional doc, mm-hmm. you know, that didn't fall into the traditional documentary format. However, like with most incredible things, once it was completed, we got a lot of really great feedback, particularly from people who were not Black, really showing appreciation for the opportunity that they had to sit there and be comfortable and look at all these different Black men's faces and listen to all these different Black men speak thoughtfully about their perspective. And one of the things that was pretty amazing about Question Bridge was that everyone was thoughtful and spoke with some insight, from the 8-year-old kid to the teenagers and young people from low income and urban environments, the proverbial hood, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. To the PhD candidates and to the prominent people we included. And I think it just went to show that when you empower people to feel like they're an expert on a subject matter or that they have something valuable to offer, that they will speak and behave from a place that is according to that. So when you empower people, they will contribute in a thoughtful and productive way.
The Boombox project, where did you get boomboxes from these days?
Right. I'm thinking he would run out.
Yeah, right.
It's like, are they still around?
Seem like a lot of them around.
And I just want you to know, Bayate, when I saw the first one, I said, oh my gosh, an homage to Radio Raheem.
Radio Raheem.
Oh, we just lost Radio Raheem this year.
Yeah, yeah. Bill. Yeah. Bill.
Nunn.
Bill Nunn. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And he was also the Dutta Man.
You don't know nothing about the Dutta Man.
You're Raheem. Do you know the significance of the Dutta Man?
Yes, yeah, from New Jack City.
Thank you. Ah!
Please. I saw New Jack City.
See, I knew that too, but I'd have to hand in my card.
Like a Geico commercial.
You said with the Geico commercial. What?
Right? Isn't that what they say? In the Geico, they used to say in the Geico ones. Everyone knows that.
Everyone knows that. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Okay. So, boom boxes.
Yeah, Radio Raheem is a very iconic and beloved character. And I think what's fascinating about Radio Raheem is that that character signifies how art and culture were shared prior to the digital age. And also he reflects the history of public music and public art within the Black and Latino communities in a very like Pan-African diasporic way. Mm-hmm. So with me, I was interested in the boombox because I thought it was such an iconic object. You know, if you look at even the signage today, the signs that say, like, no playing music in public, it's still a picture of a boombox. It's not like an iPod.
Right.
I wanted to use this iconic object that everyone recognizes and has a relationship with. Even if you're a kid and you didn't grow up with boomboxes, you remember the one your father, or your mother, or your uncle had. Or you remember them from lore. So I want to take this iconic object and then use it as a vehicle for getting people to engage in music and stories. And I feel like you can tell a lot about a community by the music they listen to and the stories they tell.
Right.
That was the concept there. And it is becoming more and more challenging to find boomboxes. When I first started this project, 6 years ago, you could find them a little bit more easily, but now a lot of it is either ordering them in advance, like online through like Amazon, mm-hmm. or spending time on eBay and other resources trying to find cheap ones that are vintage. And a lot of times I've had to actually go around to like thrift stores and Goodwills and things of that nature in the area where I'm constructing them to find old boomboxes as well. So that has been challenging, but that's also part of the appeal of the project.
I'll wrap up the Radio Raheem / Boombox conversation by saying, hey, yo, Sal, put some more mozzarella cheese on that.
Here we go.
That's a classic. That's a classic movie. It's something that I think, you know, how many years later? 26.
It's still powerful.
Years later,
yeah, yeah.
It is relevant, and yeah. Everyone should see it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Or re-see it.
Re-see it,
I watched it 3-4 years ago, okay. And it was
just
great.
As engaging.
It was just as engaging.
Yeah.
I still get mad seeing guys in Larry Bird jerseys.
In the middle of Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
Right. You're listening.
Well, that's how you can tell Brooklyn's really getting overly gentrified when you start seeing people wearing New England sports paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Scary.
But you know, that was, if you check out Martin, yeah. Martin was in Do the Right Thing.
Yes, he was.
You know, he had a good part. You
yeah.
know?
Yes.
Now, somebody with a ridiculous DC accent in the middle of Brooklyn, you know, well, whatever, because I'm a DC dude
we'll
myself.
We'll take it. Right.
But he did good. Thank you. You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we're talking with photographer, multimedia artist, filmmaker, and educator, Biate Ross Smith. One more time, Biate, please tell us how we can find you.
Yes, you can find me via my website. That's www.biate.net. That's B as in boy, AYETE.net. You can also find me on social media. My handles for Twitter and Instagram are at Biate Kenan. That's B as in boy, AYETEKENAN.
Along today's journey, we've discussed being a thinking person, question bridges, and
media consumption.
Ah, thank you, Nancy. Oh, look
at
her taking the mic. But you do realize this is my, you know, this is what I do. This
every
round
now
out the
and
show.
Then okay. I get a little out of hand. Right. I'm congested today. Give me some license.
Thank you to my co-host, or to the host, Nancy. Thanks to Jeff Newman, my engineer, and thank you to my guest, Mr. Biate Ross Smith. You've been great. I hope you've had as much fun as I've had hanging out with today's ensemble. As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr. That's M-R Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, please make sure you like us there. And if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love.